All right, we're glad to have you all back in here. Thank you for that. And this ought to be both entertaining and educational. And it's one thing I should explain to you, because a lot of people don't understand. You'll hear me call him Uncle Jack, because we actually forget in our family that we're not blood kin. We're close enough that the Batemans and the Thorntons and the Rowlands are just really all kin, and that's all we ever think about. And the Thomases too, and that's because the Bible says there's a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. So this is part of our extended family and a real treat. And you'll get to hear, the Batemans were in Taiwan as missionaries for 37 years. Pastor was there for 40 years. They've shared a lot of efforts and things together. And Uncle Jack was a POW as a child in a Japanese prisoner of war camp in the Philippines. So he'll tell you more about that. This is going to be an interview format. So Pastor's going to be Dan Rather or somebody like that. And,
you could pick somebody better than that.
Yeah. Sorry if I knew a conservative talk show host. He'll be Sean Hannity. Okay, that's about the best I can do. And he'll be interviewing Uncle Jack. And I know you guys will enjoy this. We're going to record it for posterity as well. So, Dad, go ahead.
Thank you, Brother Jack. We're honored to have you come here today to share your life story. And so I wanted to start out by asking you about your parents and where you were born.
When I discovered the world in China, and the name used to be... Okay, you can move. I can hear me, that's horrible.
What was the question? Tell us about your parents and where you were born.
My dad was in the military stationed in China. You who are history buff, there was a time called the China Rebellion years ago. And dad was stationed there. Also, they were close to Beijing. Beijing is the capital. That's where the embassy is. And the embassy only could allow so many soldiers. So they opened up military place in Tianjin, where I was born in North China, about 60 miles south of Beijing. That's my old hometown. My early days, I just got born and raised before the Japanese occupation, which became a lot different in my early days. And at that time, in China, it was divided up by different countries. China was at that time most weak. The lady who's in charge didn't have much sense. When the foreign soldier came, she ran out the gate, back gate, city gate, to the country. When she came back, she said, "I ran out from the gate. I will not go through it." So they had to build a bridge over the big wall for her to go across, and for that. And I was born there. I loved the country, loved the language, and loved the food.
Brother Jack, tell us a little bit more about your father. Now, he went to China as a soldier, an American soldier, but... what happened to him while he was in China?
Well, he was saying that during the Boxer Rebellion, Americans had soldiers there. Dad was in that, it was a 15th Infantry, and was stationed there. And he retired there and opened a restaurant. And... my son-in-law and read the inventory of the place, and he said, "What do you mean a restaurant? It's a bar." So I said, "It's a restaurant." Dad died of TB in China because of his bad health, there was not much facilities at that time.
So after your father died, where did you and your mother and your brother and sister live?
Since we're half and half, my mother had to register us with American Embassy. If we're not registered, we become Chinese citizens. So Mama had the good sense to register us, so we're American citizens. They allowed me to pay taxes of being an American citizen. That's a privilege, by the way. Since I don't make enough to pay taxes, it's your privilege. What was the question?
After your father died,
I registered at the American Embassy, and then my aunt, I had a great aunt who was a Bible teacher in the Methodist Church at that time, and she and some friends arranged us to leave the city to go out in the country, which the living is cheaper and more easy. So we left Tianjin, the main large city, and went to Tai'an. Tai'an is a city at the foot of a mountain, and it was a beautiful country.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Jack. Give us a little bit more about your mother's background and about your maternal grandparents.
My mother altogether has nine sisters and brothers. My mother always say, I was sacrificed to marry a foreigner. In those early days, you don't brag about marrying a foreigner. So she said that she married Dad, he was also in bad health, and Mama took care of him to try and nurse him back to health. He had TB, and I had TB when I was young. I always translate that a tired boy, so I had a tired boy.
Your mother was...
My mother's Chinese. My dad's American, so I'm half and half. I lean toward the Oriental side because I love the Chinese language. I love the Chinese culture. So I lean more to the Chinese side than I do at the American side.
Wasn't your mother Mongolian descent?
My mother is a Mongolian descent, so I'm a nomad. Genghis Khan is Mongolian. He went over Europe. That's my ancestor, went over Europe, and Hopi ancestors at that time.
And what do you remember about your grandparents?
My grandparent was a trader. They had a caravan between Beijing and Mongolia. My mother said when she was little, they had little boxes of colored stone that she was allowed to play. And those are the diamonds and rubies that they traded with the Mongolians in the early days. Dad had a caravan. He traded, it may sound strange. One of the things they sold to Mongolians was salt. there was no salt in Mongolia except a type of salt that you pick up off the ground, and it's also dirty. And that's one of the things they sold, is salt. And they had quite a few caravans. I remember when I was a kid, the yard was real large. We'd get camels, a caravan in our front yard. And they would come stay with us a few days, and then they'd be gone again. My grandfather caught one of the servants stealing money, and the servant had a knife, a sword, and back leg muscles. So after that, he couldn't walk anymore. He scooted on the ground.
Tell us about your grandpa's diet. What did he eat?
My grandfather is, since he's Mongolian more, about three times a week, and I'd go buy him a piece of lamb or goat, and he would take that and put it in boiling water, and just enough to change color. Then he'd take a knife and stab it and eat it, slice and eat it without salt, without any seasoning, nothing, just plain piece of meat. And I never could understand that. Anyway, that's what he liked. And just slice it and drink a little jigger. We have a little jigger this size of what we call bygar. Bygar is 110 proof, whatever that is. It's enough alcohol, you can light it. When I spray my ankle, my mother will put some of that in a tray and light it, and then get her hands in there. It somehow is not very hot, and she would rub the burning alcohol in my ankle to soothe the pain. That was one of the old remedies.
Where did you go to school when you were younger?
I went to the Tianjin American School. My early education was English. And we did not go to Chinese school till later on. So our early education was the American school, Tianjin American School. And it was a very expensive school because all the teachers are imported from the United States and England. So it was a very enjoyable time. But I was a rebel at that, even that age, because I know those folks are wealthy people. We weren't wealthy, we were not exactly poor, so I didn't associate with them. So I became an isolationist in the early age.
Well, Brother Jack, your clothes you're wearing today is somewhat unique to us. Did you have to wear that kind of clothes when you were young?
I wore this thing here. We call it dama bark. If you don't speak Chinese, you don't understand it. Dama bark. And this is Xiao Fei's here. And this hat called Mao Cher.
Now you're educated in Chinese.
Yeah, this is Mao Cher. And I did have, yeah, there it is. By the way, in the early days, Qing Dynasty, the missionaries had to have pigtails. That was a law. Everybody wore pigtails. And the missionary has, like this, false pigtails. When they go out, they put on the hat and have a false pigtail. And I remember Grandpa, when the Qing Dynasty was over and they had to cut their pigtail, he literally cried that he had to cut his pigtail off. And because that's your sign of a gentleman, your pigtail, a sign of a gentleman. So I'm a gentleman.
Brother Jack, you lived in Tianjin, and you said that after the Boxer Rebellion, several different countries had legations there. Yes. So which legation did you, your family live in?
We were in the later on in the British. See, the China at that time were very weak, so the foreign countries took advantage and divided China, and so they what we call concessions. That is land in China that is ministered by foreign countries. Like we live in the British concession, this piece of land is ministered by the British, not by the Chinese government. And you have the French concession and Italian concession. The Italian and the French concession were commercial. And then we have the Japanese concession. That's where you go and smoke opium. I sold opium one time his opium den.
Okay, explain a little bit more about the opium that you sold.
We have opium at home. My sister Sally has a stomachache, so they lit the opium pipe. She puffed about three times and no more the pain. I didn't understand then, but I know now what opium is. Everybody had opium pipes in the early days. And not much in addicts, except opium have two different prices. One is fresh. You smoke it, then you scrape it off after you burn it. And that is sold to the open den for the poor people to smoke. And one time we had a Chinese, well, I was with the Chinese community, and the Japanese wanted him to be a soldier, and we had to get things to him out of the country, so I got the second-hand opium when they had opium den, sell it, and to get money for him to leave the country. So I did sold opium one time. It wasn't a crime in those days. During the refugee time, there was one family, the refugee, when the communists came, they all, the Chinese moved south and went to Taiwan. And one lady was an addict, and she had to have her smoke, and she got lost. We never saw her again.
What was the best thing you remember about your early life there in Tianjin?
My early days?
Yes. The best thing you remember about it.
I love Chinese culture, even though I'm an American citizen. I love Chinese culture, and also, too, as Beth said, I love Chinese food. That's what we prefer. And we eat Chinese food at home. When we go out, we eat Chinese food. That sounds silly. Why not try something new? Well, nothing good enough to take place of the Chinese food. Now, chop suey is something you can't buy in a Chinese restaurant. And that is, let me tell you about the history of chop suey. There was a man, and he came in. He was hungry. He was an officer, and the guy and guys cooked something to eat, and he didn't have anything, so he took all the plates that had leftovers and put them together, and he deserved it. It was so good, and so the guy said, "What was that you cooked? It was really good." And he didn't have a name, so he called it chop suey, and chop suey means mixture. It was a mixture, all right. And so that's what you, when you eat chop suey, you eat leftovers. You eat leftovers.
Okay, Brother Jack, what happened in 1937 and 38 that changed everything for you and your brother and sister?
37, when the Japanese invaded China, we moved out into the country with the help of Methodist Mission. As I said, I have an aunt who was a Bible teacher. And we went to Tai'an, which is out in the country. We were out there, and was within the Methodist Mission. Then there was a independent Baptist missionary, heard about us, and so he was alone and lonesome. Nobody speak English to him. So he asked if we could move in with him. And got my mother's permission. We moved in and stayed there with them. And when the war broke out, the American embassy advised all the Americans to leave China. And so John Blaylock, a missionary, got permission from mother to take us out of the country. She knew if we were left in the country, it would be very difficult because we were half and half. And we left China and then went to the Philippines. We thought, well, we're finally free, except December 7th, Pearl Harbor, and the Philippines fell right away. We was in Japanese prison camp in Philippines for 3 years in the University of Las Banas, the University of San Tomas. We was there in Japanese prison camp for 3 years.
Brother Jack, before we get into that too much, tell about how you left China.
How?
Yeah, how?
In those days there's no airplane. It's all by boat. And I packed my stuff that I wanted. In fact, I still have the old suitcase. And on top of that suitcase, I had a book, How to Learn Japanese. So we had to be inspected by Japanese MPs, all the luggage. So he opened my luggage and saw the book on top, said, How to Learn Japanese. And he just rattled out a lot of Japanese. I didn't know a word. I just smiled out of my head. She closed the suitcase. And I was gone and got on the ship. And so that's how I carried a lot of stuff with me because of the inspection.
What was it like to live under the Japanese occupation there in China?
Japanese occupation in prison camp, if you don't bother them, they don't bother you. We almost starved to death. We had the food they call in Philippines, in Tagalog, it was called lugaw. Lugaw is just rice boiled to the extent that it become a paste. You don't have a kernel. You have volume, but except after you eat it, and about an hour later, you're as hungry as you started. So we were on a starvation diet at that time. We ate everything. In fact, the place we went to in prison camp was Las Banas, which was a university. And there was a professor that lived in that university. And he had a dog he raised and loved it. And somebody stole that dog for food one time. Of course, when you're hungry, you eat anything. We ate weeds. In fact, when I came back here, worked for a company, and the work was light. He said, why don't you go back there and chop the weeds? So I went back to the backyard, chopped the weed, came back. I said, no, I can't do it. He said, why? I said, that's what I ate when I was a prison kid. It kept me from dying. So I said, I'd do anything. I've been tough to weeds. We call it ragweeds. You get a tender leaf and boil it. In fact, in front of our barracks was a banana tree we claimed to be ours. And for some reason, they never produced the bananas. So we chopped it down to 80th. If you take all the outside part of the banana tree, they have a nice soft heart. I guess it's kind of starchy. And we ate that.
Brother Jack, I'm curious to know why you, when you left China, why did you stop over in the Philippines?
We stopped in the Philippines because at that time it was under American control. We thought, well, that was safe. And we got there in September, December, Pearl Harbor. In January, we was put in prison camp. So that we was leaving, but since we were under American flag in the Philippines, we thought we'd be safe. But it wasn't very safe. And so we spent 3 years and 1 month in a prison camp.
You said 3 years and 1 month?
Yes.
Okay.
It's the strangest thing. Their people did die quite often. They have what they call beriberi. Beriberi is a disease for lack of fresh fruit and vegetables. Their leg swells up and it goes up to the way up to the top and then goes to the heart and you die. The Japanese put it down, they died of a heart attack. That's not unusual, but they never did put down as they died of beriberi. The heart attack is called beriberi for lack of fresh food and vegetable. We had three crews digging graves at that time.
Well, Brother Jack, tell us a little bit more about your life as a POW there in the Philippines. Did you enjoy it, or was it something terrible that you remember?
I enjoyed it. That was strange. There was a guy, we had the ex-internee meeting, and there was a guy getting recordings. And he didn't want to write it. He wanted the oral recording. So he came to me, and he said, would you like to say something? I said, no. Next day, he asked me again, but this time my granddaughter was with me. And I turned him down, and then my granddaughter said, why did you turn him down? I said, if you listen, everybody said how bad it was, how terrible it was, and I come up and said, man, I had a good time. Either they're lying or I'm crazy. So I never did answer. Being raised in Asia made a lot of difference. I was raised in China. And we're used to eating rice, so lugao, and it wasn't much. And so because we were raised in Asia, we could take a lot more of the starchy food than others. But there was one good advantage. We had people who had not seen their feet in a long time. But before the camp was over, they could bend over and tie their shoestrings. So there was a one advantage to that. I was 16, 13, in prison camp.
Yeah. How old were you when you left China and went to the Philippines?
I was 13, yeah. Okay. 13, and so I entered prison camp. Actually, I became 14. My birthday was in January, and so it was 14, and I came out when I was 17 out of prison camp.
So how were you treated by the Japanese while you were in the
prison camp? Besides starvation diet, You don't bother them, they don't bother you. Because we were liberated by 11th Airborne. According to the information, all the people in prison camp was going to be killed before the Japanese retreat. And they had the machine guns already. Because of this news, the paratroopers, 11th Airborne, dropped behind Japanese line and liberated us from the prison camp. Otherwise, we'd be all dead that morning. They have during the roll call, they was going to kill everybody before they leave.
In the internment camp for 3 years, what did you eat?
Well, first we in fact, when we had when the Japanese, you can tell who is winning. When the Japanese winning, our food rationing was good, not excellent but good. When Japanese were losing, we had lousy food. So do you want good food? And we're winning or lousy food and they're losing. So it was a kind of strange situation.
What were some of the unusual things that you ate to keep from scarring?
We ate anything. We ate weed that is edible. And I said that about our banana tree. We chopped down and ate it. And also, I worked in the kitchen. And we have the lugao, which is rice that is boiled to just a paste. And when they dish it out, you better not give one person a little bit more because everybody's standing like a bunch of vultures watching you dish out the food. And he would measure it out and with a ladle and with a paddle and to dish it out. And we stood there. I was working the kitchen. See, when they finished dishing out the lugao, there's still a lot of they'll stick on the pot. The ladle can't do it. So a friend and I, Henry Johnson, we made a couple squeegees. So when we're ready to take the food back to the kitchen, we squeegee the pot out, and then we almost could get another ration from the squeegees. Mostly we ate lugao in that part. And the last meal we had was we had two pigs that were raised in the camp. Each pig weighs about 20 pounds. So two pigs, about 40 pounds. And that was cooked for 2,000 people. So we got a smell of it, that's it.
Okay, what was your job? No, that's you've already answered that question. How many people were in the POW camp?
We were about 2,000 in the camp. And in Santa Monica, Los Angeles later on, about 2,000.
Were there any missionaries in the camp?
Well, how many? There were doctors, lawyers, nurses, and so all kind of people there. And in the early days, the people that's rich people, they have their cook bring food to the gate. And Henry Johnson and I would go pick it up and deliver it to individuals. We always had a taste before we got there. We had a delivery job, and we pick up the food and take it to individuals. And they build what they call shanties, little bamboo dwellings between buildings. And people stayed there all day, and they ate there, they cooked there. In the beginning, when we had ladies that pick out bugs in the rice before they cook it, and little rocks, and then also bugs. And later on, they just picked rocks out of the rice. They let the bug in, your side that at least that is extra protein when they eat it. So they just pick out the rocks and then they just boil everything. When you get hungry, you ever fasted before? First 3 days of fasting is horrible. After the fourth day, you don't feel so bad. Well, we're, in a sense, doing that. Actually, during the latter part, we got a pound of rice, each person with a husk on it. So we had to take a board and put the rice on the table and rub it. The friction would take the husk out. The husk is very hard and sharp. The two guys didn't do it and just bought and ate it. Both of them died of internal bleeding. And we had, after liberation, there was two guys went out and bought chicken. And they really enjoyed it. And both of them died in digestions. And also after liberation, we were not allowed to eat anything heavy. We started with soup because our stomach, eating lubao so long, it had no power to digest. We ate just soup. And then from soup, we went up to Spam. Now, you who are in the military, Spam was wonderful. And by the way, Spam is a Hawaiian dish. If you go to Hawaii, every other restaurant serves Spam. I would have thought Spam was horse meat, but I found out later it wasn't. And
Brother Jack, tell us a little bit more about the day you were liberated.
We were liberated by paratroopers, and they dropped behind Japanese lines. And then we got to Laguna Dubai. It's a bay between the Japanese side and the American side. And we got into the Amtrak and went across Laguna Dubai, which is it's a large bay. And as we was traveling two things happened when I was there. One, the old man next to me said, "This lake is sure shallow. We're running on it." I said, "We're not running on it. We're floating on it." And he was amazed. Those Amtraks, heavy it is, it's floating on water. And so we got across on the other
side. Was there still fighting going on between the Americans and the Chinese at that time?
Yeah, the Japanese. There was still fighting. In fact, when we got to Laguna Dubai going across, the Japanese started shooting mortars at us. One Amtrak was hit, but nobody hurt. And then another experience is a guy next to me, and when the Japanese started throwing mortars at us, they turned out a 50 caliber machine gun, and a couple of shells landed on this guy's neck that was up under was underneath it there, lying down, and hit on his neck. And it was hot. It was 50 caliber. And he looked up, he said, "I'm shot, I'm shot, I'm shot." I said, "No, you're not going to die yet." Those two was really, at that time, kind of comical. Even during that situation.
Well, how did you feel about being liberated?
During the liberation, you know, it's a strange thing. We've been in prison camp 3 years, actually 3 years and 1 month. And those folks who was in camp, the junk they had that they kept as their own for 3 years, and they will not leave it. It's junk. It's nothing worth anything. But because they had it that long, they wouldn't leave it. Now, the paratrooper has to burn the barracks down in order for the people to leave it. It was strange to me, but it, thinking back, it's not so strange. That is what they had. It may be junk. That was theirs for 3 years. But they didn't want to leave it. But it was no use to carry it. It's junk. And so the paratroopers had to burn the barracks down for these people to leave the junk that they have for 3 years.
Well, tell us about your trip to the United States. Did you go with John Blaylock, the missionary?
Yeah, we went after liberated, and we got on the ship to come to the United States. We was on a ship, SS Everly. It's a French ship, and they was not going to carry passengers, but they were empty, so they agreed to carry passengers, and they were going to Vietnam. Vietnam, once upon a time, was under the French, and that ship that we was on was sunk in Vietnam, and when we got out, the young ladies would get chocolate from the GIs. GI chocolate is fortified with vitamins, and they eat it, and then they got to go to the hospital, get pumped out, they won't digest. And then they come out, stand in line again, and get some more chocolate, eat it, and then they get pumped out. I couldn't understand that because I didn't much care for that chocolate, but they eat chocolate, get pumped out, and they get some more from the GI, stand in line, eat it as they go down the line, and they get to the hospital, get pumped.
Okay, on the way, did you go on the same ship with John Blaylock?
We came, now I can hear myself. Oh, what a sweet voice that is. What was I supposed to say?
Okay, did you go with John Blaylock back to the States?
Yeah, we came back to stay with John Blaylock. And then my brother stayed back and got a job right off, of course.
You mean in California?
Yeah, there was a draft at that time because of war. And because we were in prison camp, we were reclassified as 4-H, not 4-F. 4-F means something wrong with you. And we were 4-H, which means that we're exempt because of war. So we didn't have to go in the military. I didn't.
So after you arrived in California, who did you live with?
I lived with Blaylock for a while. And I lived with Brother Emin. He worked in the oil company around the Concord where I lived. And by the way, in California, it's Concord. In the coast, east coast, is Concord. So we lived in the Concord. And which I got a job and made $1 an hour, and I was rich. And worked there in the camp, in the oil company, $1 an hour. And because of my being in prison camp, I was not drafted in the military, so I never did. They asked my brother to join to be a translator. They never agreed on it, so he never went. They never did ask me. And I was called to preach in California.
Okay, let's move back first. Let's tell about your experience of salvation. How did you come to know the Lord?
When we were with John Blaylock, we read the Bible and we talk about the Bible, but I never was understood it till I came to the States. We was in CAF, California, near Bakersfield, and the There, that's where I was saved in Taft, California. And I understood what the gospel was. And I was saved there. And I was called to preach in Taft. So after the Lord called me to preach, I knew I had to go to school. From Asia background, education is most important. So there was a group came from Jacksonville to advertise a school.
That's Jacksonville College.
Jacksonville College.
Yeah, in Texas.
Just to hear how smart I was, I didn't have any money, but IRS came $60. And it was $60, and then I knew the Lord wanted me to go to Texas to go to school. And I didn't know what to do with $60. And I got to Jacksonville, and I had the $30 left. I paid $25 for 3 weeks room and board and some books, and had $5 left. And I've been living off that $5 ever since. Every time I reach into it, there it is. Looking back, I was talking to some friends last week. How did I survive in those days? When I came to Texas, I stopped at El Paso or the bus, the Greyhound bus. And I rode the Greyhound bus 2 days and one night from Northern California to Jacksonville, Texas. And I was going to buy me a sister there. Simply, I've been watching TV. Everybody in Texas had a six shooter, and except I didn't have any money. I looked at that shop and saw one, but I ready to buy me a six shooter, and I didn't. And got to Texas.
So you enrolled in Jacksonville College.
Yeah, I enrolled in Jacksonville College. And then from there to Wayland College. By the way, that's where I met my sweetie pie.
Well, let's don't get ahead of ourselves, Jack. What happened to cause you to go to San Antonio?
I had TB, and I was in the sanatorium for a year and 6 months with TB. Torn breeches or tire boy, whatever you want to call it. And it was strange being in the hospital on the bed, stay there. In those days, TB was also called convalescent. You're there to wait to die. I mean, they would come and nurses close the doors. And my window is outside in the back, and I look at the back of this building, and there would be a hearse out there. And one of my favorite songs, I sing, and everybody complained is, "Oh, bury me now in the lone prairie." These words came low and mournfully, in a TB hospital, people dying. That's not exactly sorry you want to say, but I did.
Well, there's a question from the audience. What did he eat or swallow to help break the TB fever?
At that time, it's also called convalescent. The TB, at that time, there was no medicine. Later on, streptomycin came. And in those days, when you had TB, you just wait to die. There's no hope. I was a year, 6 months, and in the hospital. And it was, when I went out, first time I went out, a preacher friend in San Antonio said, "Hey, come on out. Drive around town." So I went over, and the nurse said, "You want to take the elevator down?" I said, "No, I want to walk." And I didn't realize walking on flat surface and going downstairs is two different. First step. And if I didn't grab the rail, I would have gone down head first. And the nurse was really excited. She asked again, "Do you want to ride the elevator?" Well, being young and tough, I said no. I walked down those stairs. I grabbed the banister up the hallway down. But when I came back, I took the elevator. But I didn't want to lose face then. I could look in the eye, I'm sure. Don't want to lose it.
Did they ever feed you tadpoles?
Oh. When I was a kid, we ate tadpole. In China at that time, tadpole, you do it in the summer. It's a cooling agent. There people sell goldfish with that tadpole, and we buy about 8 or 9, and then just drink it. And you feel it weekly, all the way probably down to the animals. Well, after that, I don't feel it anymore. They go weekly down. And last time I had that, when I was 15 or 16, last time I had tadpole. So
What's the value?
It's supposed to keep your inner temperature. The Chinese call it the inner temperature down. And we ate that every spring. That was a tradition. Every spring, in the early days here, you had sulfur molasses. Remember those days? Y'all are too young. And spring, they take sulfur and molasses in this country for spring food.
Jack, tell us about your romance with your wife, Latrell.
Oh. How many hours do you have? I tell you, I married the sweetest girl in Texas. And she's from Lubbock, and the Lord called, she was called to go to Asia as missionary. And she'd been reading a lot of old missionary books. And most of missionary books in the early days were written by old maids. And she thought she had to be an old maid to be a missionary. And I had to convince her that she needed to get married, and then convince her she needed to marry me, nobody else. She is the sweetest thing, and a sweet rock, though. It's okay, she passed on. I report to her once in a while. She is from Lubbock, Texas, and the Lord called her to preach to be a missionary in the Orient.
And how many times did you have to propose?
I proposed to her a whole year, and she said, "I sound like a broken record. Will you marry me? Will you marry me?" Every time I see her, I say, "Will you marry me?" And the Chinese have a saying, you could wear a steel rod down to a needle if you have patience. And I had patience. I wore that rod down to a needle, and she said yes. And after she said yes, I was coming back from prayer meeting, and I didn't say anything until we got to the girls' dorm in Jacksonville. I said, "Did you say yes?" She said, "Yes." "Why?" I said, "I've been hearing no for a whole year." "No, no, no, yes." It didn't go in just right. And so when I asked her again, I said, "Did you say yes?" And then I floated from the girls' dorm all the way to the boys' dorm. I didn't hit the ground. I got into the boys' dorm, T.J. Osborne, and looked at me. And first thing he said was, "Did you say yes?" I said, "Yes, how do you know?" He says, "Written all over your face." And
well, Well, what was life like in those early days of your marriage?
I was very inconsiderate to Charles and my wife. And when we traveled to Taiwan, I was back home, but she never been there. And she had a lot of adjusting to do, and I didn't realize that when we were first to Taiwan. We are missionaries had 4-year terms because we didn't have anyone take our place in Taiwan. We stayed there 7 years. That was a bad choice. To me, it didn't make any difference, but I didn't think about travel. This is a new country, new food, new traditions, I was very, very selfish because I was home, but she's not.
How old was she?
How do I know?
Okay.
20.
Oh, she's
20.
When you married her?
She was 19, by the way. I was 22. And finally convinced her that two can live as cheap as one. So,
when did the two of you decide that you wanted to go to Taiwan as missionaries?
That's one of the qualifications. I never dated unless that person was going to be a missionary. If I had the Lord call me a missionary, I hooked up with somebody who is not going to be a missionary, that would be a conflict. So one of my qualifications, besides being pretty and smart, is she's going to be a missionary. So that's how we really hooked up. She was going the same way as I was.
What year did y'all go to Taiwan as missionaries?
53. Well, thank you. Went to Taiwan 1953. We was there 37 years, and never regretted a day. When we went there, my wife was expecting number two, Paul. So we got a free ticket for Paul and on the airlines. And we was there 9 weeks. And one day he was born. There was a hospital, Mackay Hospital, run by Presbyterian missionaries. And when she went over there to maternity ward, we met a lot of good missionary friends. Time to really, the Lord bless. We met some of these missionaries, and they gave us some good advice. And we have 5 children. 4 was born in Taiwan. Number one is one born in the States. When they were young, he always say, "I'm a Texan." He always is Chinese. So he was only Texan in the family.
And this is
the
baby.
Yeah, that's Charmin.
Brother Jack, you speak very standard Mandarin today. In fact, I would have to say your Chinese is better than your English. Okay. I hope that doesn't insult you.
Go ahead, keep it up.
But my question is this. Were you able to preach in Chinese immediately after you arrived in Taiwan?
No. I could understand Chinese, but since I haven't spoken Chinese in a long time, and if I went to a language school for a while there, and we had a bunch of old missionaries, and they put us into one language class. We didn't learn about them, but we had a good time.
And how long was it before you preached your first sermon in Chinese?
I don't really remember. I think it's because of I didn't have a Christian vocabulary when I was growing up.
deal with the Rutgers has vocabulary. So I had to learn a lot of biblical vocabulary during that time, time one. And so it took me, I think, at least 6 months before I tried to speak or preach in Chinese. So it was back there, but I had to dig it out.
But what was the most difficult thing for you in your almost 40 years as a missionary?
To me, I felt like I come home. So it was no pressure there. As I said, I was very foolish. Didn't realize that that was a new environment for Trip, for my wife. And I said, I understood that. And she almost had a nervous breakdown, really, during the first 7 years. We had, first term was four, we had four youngins, didn't we? We had number two, Paul, number three, Mark, number four is Ann, and then we had Bruce. And he always wonder why we didn't give him a biblical name. We have John, Paul, Mark, Ann, Bruce. And the girl was Ann. She was a conjunction. John, Paul, Mark, Ann, Bruce.
So what was the most satisfying thing for you in those years in Taiwan?
I knew where the Lord wanted me. That's the main thing for each one of you. Be sure where you are going or where you are, that you are centered of the Lord's will. And there's no greater joy than you know in the center of God's will. And there's no greater sadness is when you're not in the Lord's will and outside the Lord's will. So be careful and always seek God's will and God's first. And it's amazing. God knows a lot more about you than you do yourself. And He can guide you and give you the places to be wherever. Maybe the Lord has called you to be a missionary and make sure that you are called and you surrender, and then you'll be joyful. That's a joyful time when you know the Lord is calling you and you're doing what the Lord wants you to do. And then you would be really happy because you know where the Lord wants you to be and you're there. And that's one of the things when I came to Texas to go to school is I knew that's where the Lord wanted me to be. And $60 wasn't much to go from California to Texas to go to school. Actually, I was talking to my son-in-law, who's very intelligent in finances. He's working in the bank. I said, Dan, if I was as smart as you about finances, I still be in California and figure out how I get to Texas. But I didn't know. I didn't know where my next meal come from, didn't know where my school tuition come from, and didn't know anything. But I just know the Lord wanted me to go to Texas. And I came to Texas, and that was it. And the Lord had blessed, because this is where, at the early day, want to be. I went to go to college there in Jacksonville, and really was enjoyed from there. Went to Wayland College, which is a Southern Baptist school. I never did mix with them well because I was a Southern Baptist, but they were all friendly and nice. But I knew the word of the Lord won, and be sure to find them. Maybe, don't they? If the Lord called you to someplace, and don't they somebody who's not going there? Either you're going to disobey God, or and that messes up, or you're going to do something that is silly.
Brother Jack, tell us about your ministry since you retired as a missionary in Taiwan.
After 37 years of missionary, I retired. Actually, I'm not retired. I'm recycled. Recycled is to take something old and make something new out of it. I'm recycling. I work with a group of Chinese people in Plano, Texas, in a retirement home. This morning we had a big group. We had about 30 this morning at the retirement home that I work with them. And it's really Lord bless. I go over there, have good fellowship, and they feed me. And at the end of the day, then they pay me. A lot of people like a job and they enjoy what you're doing, and then they feed you, and then they pay you. I'm not going to give up that job, by the way. So don't worry about it.
Well, Brother Jack, my last question, why do you believe that every person should believe in Jesus?
Because, first of all, the Bible says so. Because Jesus is the only answer. There's no second answer in the world for our life. And Christ is the only answer and the only Savior and the one to give you eternal life. And you get what the Psalm says, joy unspeakable and full of glory. And it's a joyful time to be in the center of God's will. Know that this is where you belong. And that's the happiest life. You know, I was talking to my wife before she passed away. I said, you know, people argue and then they kiss and make up. I said, we never argue and kiss and make up. I said, let's have an argument so we can kiss and make up. And she didn't believe in that.
Okay, I wonder if somebody out in the audience has a question you'd like to ask Jack. Judy.
Okay, I heard him talk about his time in the prison camp before, and remember him talking about the difference between those who lived and died, and there was one person who was really healthy or strong, but he died, and then
there was a guy across from me in the barracks. He was a bodybuilder. And he could sit on the floor and feet straight out and pull himself up on the rope. But he had such a negative attitude. And, we're going to die here. We're going to die here. And he died there. By all means, he should be lived, get out of there, but he has such a negative attitude, and we're going to die here, and he died there, as physically good and everything, because his negative attitude. Well, he was a strong guy, bodybuilder, and he died, and
what did you do for fun? In the POW camp, since you said you had fun there.
Oh, I had, fun is determined by individuals. We had a bull, and we had a cow, and I used the bull to plow up gardens and things. So I had learn how to plow. And the cow is younger, I could ride it. I just have my helper carry the bull way down the road, and I jump on the cow and they take off. And one time I was really embarrassed, and we was going down the street real fast, and they pulled the bull and went around the corner. And I knew the speed that cow was going, he couldn't turn. Well, he did. I didn't. He turned, the cow turned right, and I went straight. And it hurt. There was a lot of people around there. That was worse than the pain from falling on the ground. And I did plowing. I worked in the kitchen.
Did y'all ever play ball?
Hmm?
Did y'all play ball?
Yeah, we played ball. That's where I learned to play football. I've never seen one of those things before. Now, in China,
you talk about American football?
The American football. We play rugby in China, in Asia. So, but I never seen a football before. I learned to play football. And that would, usually when it had a big rain, our camp would be flooded. And we'd go out and play football in that water. And that was a lot of fun, of course.
Okay, Jim.
Did you have dreams in prison camp?
Dream?
Never thought about it.
No, never thought about dreams. I guess not.
But by dreams, you mean nighttime dreams or dreams about what's going to happen in the future?
Preoccupations, food.
Yeah, of course. You know, the strangest thing, during the latter part of the camp, people starving. You know what they were doing? They was going around exchanging recipes. One guy said, I'm going to bake a cake so big, I'm going to eat my way through. During that starve time, people going around swapping recipes. It also gave them a kind of something forward to look into. I'll get out of here and I'm going to go. And one guy, he said, I'm going to bake me a cake so big, I'm going to eat one good, eat it through, the cake. And
another question.
Tell them what all you use coconut for in the camp. I think you told me you put it on your feet.
Oh, that was outside the camp. One of the things that we used outside the camp to clean the floor, we didn't have equipment. We take the whole coconut and take a saw, cut it. And, there's white meat. You take the white meat out, and you have the hard shell. We chipped away the hard shell back, and then the coconut shell, the whole thing, it's like a brush. We put that on our floor, and then we put it 1 foot on it. We work it backwards and forwards to clean our floors. Of course, coconut oil is something great now. We ate coconut oil because we were too poor to have anything else. Rich people didn't drink or use coconut oil or coconut oil at that time.
Okay, I think it's about time for us to bring this to a close. Brother Jack, we thank you so much for coming and sharing your story with us.
I like this guy here.
And just to make this end real well, Brother Jack, would you lead us in the closing prayer in Chinese?
Okay. 我们是每天我们感谢荣耀你的生命，谢谢你有这机会为你做一个美好的见证，因为你的爱，你的怜悯，我们所有的今天。 主啊，请你带领我们，要时常的在生活之中，高举你的十字架，叫人知道除了耶稣基督以外，我们没有别的能得救的方法，帮助我们在每天生活之中，能够为你做一个美好的见证。请你怜悯我们，我们正祷告不配，奉主耶稣基督名求。
Amen.
So the Bible said, don't speak in tongues unless you have an interpreter. So we're scriptural. He can interpret that.
Yeah. And Jimmy, his big older brother.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Brother Jack.
Well, thank you. By the way, he came and slept in my place one night to babysit.
You know, it's the 2nd of January, he's going to be drinking, so what's the bigger party then?
Yep.
Well, I thought that everybody was...